Hello there. Today is Friday, March 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the fallout over the Mueller report leads to a chaotic hearing in the U.S. House of Representatives.
I don't think it's okay. I think it's immoral. I think it's unethical. I think it's unpatriotic. And yes, I think it's corrupt. And evidence of collusion.
The state of New York targets a billionaire family behind the opioid OxyContin. Also ahead, the world's rarest ape is threatened by extinction by a hydro dam. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump presenting himself as both vindicated and vindictive. He was fired up Thursday, turning the findings of the special counsel's Russia investigation into a political weapon at a boisterous Michigan rally that was part victory lap, part 2020 campaign push. With Robert Mueller's investigation largely over, Trump unleashed a fervent diatribe from the stage about the inquiry and warned that those behind the probe would be held accountable.
The Russia witch hunt was a plan by those who lost the election to try and illegally regain power by framing innocent Americans, many of them. They suffered with an elaborate hoax. They wanted to destroy a movement like our country has never seen before.
Trump's allies earlier tangled with one of his most prominent Democratic critics during a chaotic congressional hearing on Thursday, hours after Trump went on Twitter to demand that Democrat Adam Schiff resign from Congress. Republican lawmakers called him to quit as chair of the House Intelligence Committee over his comments that there was significant evidence that the president and his associates conspired with Russia. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
It's now up to Nancy Pelosi to remove Chairman Schiff. We need to restore the trust in the Intelligence Committee.
Schiff quickly fired back, calling actions by the president and his associates unpatriotic and corrupt, and said there is clear evidence of wrongdoing by President Trump and his associates that Republicans seem to be ignoring.
I do not think that conduct, criminal or not, is okay. And the day we do think that's okay is the day we will look back and say that is the day America lost its way.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, shortly after the hearing, came to Schiff's defense, calling the actions of Trump and Republicans shameful and irresponsible.
What is the president afraid of? Is he afraid of the truth, that he would go after a member, a chairman of a committee, a respected chairman of a committee in the Congress? I think they're just scaredy cats. They just don't know what to do.
Earlier, she blasted Attorney General William Barr for his four-page summary of the Mueller report, calling it condescending.
No, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. We do not need your interpretation. Show us the report, and we can draw our own conclusions. We don't need you interpreting for us.
Earlier, I got some insight into the Mueller report fallout with Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
I think it's reasonable to be skeptical that we're not getting the entire story of the Mueller report and that the fairly short summary from Attorney General Barr and the Justice Department doesn't necessarily shed light on all the details of this report, which sounds like it's really quite voluminous. There was a report, it's at least 300 pages long, I believe. So presumably, despite the top-line conclusions that the president touting as a big win for himself, there probably are some details in this report that are not particularly flattering to the White House. I think if the Mueller report was 100% positive for the White House, the report probably already would be out. And so we're in this position where we're trying to make judgments based on a document that outside of Mueller's team and some people in the Justice Department, no one's actually seen. So that's what's confusing. The other thing is that as the Mueller investigation was unfolding over the last couple of years, it did not seem like the big news items that came out of that report and the indictments of various people close to the president really did all that much to public opinion one way or the other. And sure enough, I think we're seeing in the days after the finalizing of the Mueller report and the end of the investigation, for as interesting and I think as important as the Mueller investigation has been, it's not something that seemed to have a big impact on people's feelings about the president, either positive or negative.
A lot of Democratic lawmakers are also saying that this report should have gone from Mueller to Congress and that he potentially meant for it to go to Congress and not the attorney general, who had some opinions about the inability to convict a president for obstruction of justice to begin with, so that he wasn't totally impartial. Do you think that Mueller meant for that to go to Congress, or is it more speculation at this point?
Mueller is not someone who is in the business of making public statements, really, and so it's impossible to know what his intent was. And without seeing the full report, it's hard to know exactly what he fully recommended as next steps. And look, I mean, Bill Barr is a recent appointee of the president, and that's always sort of a conflict kind of built into the way the executive branch works, which is that Justice Department, which is supposed to be impartial, nonetheless is led by a man in the attorney general who answers to the president. But again, we're in this position where we're trying to discern the absolute meaning of a document that, again, we really have not seen.
But wouldn't you think that the attorney general, if for nothing else, then appearances, wouldn't want it to seem as though he's trying to whitewash the report?
Well, it may be that the attorney general feels the summary document that he put out on Sunday painted the president in a more positive light potentially than the report itself did, and now he's going to do what he can to prevent whatever may be salacious in the actual report from getting out, and hope that what people remember is the big headlines from Sunday at Monday and not whatever the follow-up is when more details of the report eventually come out, assuming that they do come out.
The president is really taking a big victory lap. He's feeling vindicated, being very boastful about his feelings. The Republicans, his allies in Congress, have really taken his talking points and run with it, and going so far as to call out House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff to step down as chair of the committee.
American political rhetoric can be pretty over the top. All I can say is that the president and his allies calling out people for statements that they don't think are accurate, at the very least, it's hypocritical, given that the president is not really someone who is averse to not telling the truth.
Do you think it's risky for the president and Republicans to be gloating after the Mueller report, given that we really don't know what's in it, and given that there are all these other investigations targeting the president?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that they're spiking the football before the game's over here. But there was always the possibility that Mueller would recommend the president or his relatives or something to be indicted over this, and that they would find legal reasons to say that there was some sort of crime committed, again, by the president or by more of his associates. And so from that perspective, you can understand why these top-line findings that Barr released on Sunday would be something that the president would feel good about and that Republicans would feel good about. But just because the president isn't in legal jeopardy, that doesn't mean that the Mueller report, when and if it comes out, won't be politically damaging in some way.
That's Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Trump renews his threat to close the southern border with Mexico. Nicolas Maduro's government bans Guaido from holding office for 15 years. Overrun with migrants, California County sues the Trump administration. And the UN urges Eritrea to clarify the fate of dozens of missing people. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Britain's Parliament will hold a special sitting today to discuss and vote on Brexit, potentially unlocking a delay to the country's exit from the European Union, but falling short of the criteria needed to formally ratify the deal. Reporter Amy Gutman joins us from London. Amy, Theresa May's deal is back on the table for this vote, but it's already failed twice. Why vote again?
Well, a couple of major things have changed. One of the big things is that earlier in the week, Theresa May offered to resign if she can deliver Brexit. That is her whole reason for being prime minister, she believes, and that is her job, to deliver Brexit. That's really all she wants to do. This is not about ego for her. So that basically means she's offering to step down in exchange for votes. So there are some key people in her party who have resisted voting with her proposal throughout the multiple votes that we've had at this point. It's easy to lose count. And so she's so desperate to get her party on board, to get this agreement passed in Parliament, that she has offered to step down again in exchange for votes, essentially, so that the UK can commit to a Brexit date, because the UK cannot commit to a Brexit date without agreement on a withdrawal plan. Now, Theresa May is being strategic about this. She knows that there are members of her party who are angling for her job, and so she's dangled this as the carrot. One of the key people that she's targeting is Boris Johnson, who is a very controversial figure and who has long held very open ambitions to be prime minister. So interestingly, or perhaps unsurprisingly, after defying Mrs. May at every single turn of this process, he has now thrown his support behind her latest proposal in what is not even a thinly veiled attempt to exert his ambitions for power.
So how has Theresa May's proposal changed?
The vote later today will only cover the withdrawal agreement. Unlike previous proposals, it will not include the future political declaration. So it's much more limited in scope, and this is by design. Theresa May has chosen to focus strictly on what needs to be covered right now. The name of the game for Theresa May is to get this passed, finally get this through, and get Britain an agreed-upon exit date with the EU. And she believes she can do that with this very limited agreement. If she can do that, if she can get a consensus and if she can get this voted through later today, she can then go to the EU and justify extending the UK's withdrawal until May 22nd. Now, why is this date so important? It's the last date the UK can leave the EU without having to participate in the European elections. That would mean electing British members of the EU Parliament, which, of course, no one wants to do because that's like getting engaged all over again.
Good analogy, given that we're talking about this as like a divorce from the EU. So how are businesses responding to all the uncertainty?
Well, British and even businesses in other countries, particularly in Europe, have been in limbo for many months. And there are several sectors where there's been complete stagnation because the uncertainty has caused a sort of paralysis, companies reducing investment and holding off on developments altogether because they don't know the outcome yet and how it will impact their business, trade agreements, employment structures. Meantime, unemployment in the UK is quite low these days, but we could see problems on the reverse side of that. We've seen a drop in interest from European job seekers over the last 3 years, particularly in certain sectors like agriculture, where, interestingly, a lot of the farming communities voted to leave the EU, and yet a lot of the farmers are now struggling to recruit workers because typically they came from the EU. So since Brexit was voted on over the last 3 years, we've seen a big drop in European job seekers, and that has only dropped lower over the last year as we get closer and closer to Brexit and as people are more uncertain about what the official arrangements are going to be.
All right. London-based reporter Amy Gutman, we thank you for your perspective. Icelandic budget airline WOW Air has ceased operations, stranding passengers across two continents. AP correspondent Zurya Shakely has the latest.
In a statement on its website, the airline, which had earlier suspended all its flights, told passengers there would be no further flights and advised them to check flights with other airlines for ways to reach their destinations. The airline, founded by entrepreneur Skoli Mogensen, began operations in 2012 and specialized in ultra-cheap flights between North America and Europe. Its bankruptcy comes after 6 months of turbulent negotiations to sell the low-cost carrier. First to its main rival and flagship carrier Icelandair, and later to Indigo Partners, an American company operating the airline Wizz. I'm Zaria Shakli.
New York State has filed a lawsuit against some of the largest manufacturers and distributors of opioids. Thursday, New York Attorney General Letitia James said the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, shuffled considerable amounts of money collected at the expense of those who became addicted to the products. And she said the Sacklers amassed billions as the company for years used deceptive marketing to drive up sales for painkillers. The Sackler family and the state of Oklahoma, meanwhile, this week reached a $270 million opioid settlement over the drug maker's role in addicting people to OxyContin. Harry Nelson, managing partner of Los Angeles healthcare law firm Nelson Hardiman, and author of The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain, joined us earlier. I asked him, why is this settlement a big deal?
The last major settlement that any state made with Purdue Pharma and the other opioid drug makers was in the state of Kentucky in 2015 for $24 million. As we've been learning more about the fallout from the opioid crisis and the harm as well as the misconduct and the disturbing behavior by Purdue Pharma executives and other drug makers, the stakes have been going up and up. And we have roughly 1,600 lawsuits in this country and plaintiff lawyers threatening a multi-trillion dollar settlement that would dwarf any other mass tort case in American history, like tobacco, like the big tobacco litigation. It's been serious enough that Purdue Pharma, which is going to be the lead defendant, announced that it was considering bankruptcy. What's significant about this case is it shows that Purdue's threat of bankruptcy was taken seriously enough by the state of Oklahoma to settle this case. And it also makes clear that, as occurred in this case, when a judge puts pressure on the parties by forcing a trial date, both the drug maker and the state were motivated to settle the case, which is important for all of these other cases. Most of the cases are consolidated in Cleveland before federal judge Dan Polster, and he's got the first trial date set for October. So it's very likely that this settlement is going to be a forerunner of future settlements in these other cases that states have brought to various state courts.
So you believe this will impact other opioid-related lawsuits?
The class action lawyers pursuing cases on behalf of states, cities, Native American tribes, and all of the other injured parties who have suffered harm from the opioid crisis have been enjoying this greater public awareness of how much villainy there was, about how much misconduct there was, and demonization of the opioid drug makers, and that has been driving the numbers higher, as well as just more public health data about how severe the crisis is. And that's made it hard to settle these cases because on the other side, the pressure, the bringing the number up and putting multi-trillion dollar numbers has scared the drug makers, the drug distributors away from the settlement table. But I think this case shows that judges do have real power to force concessions on both sides and to help get some tangible numbers that hopefully will bring some relief to both the patients that are suffering, to the communities and law enforcement and healthcare systems that are being forced to absorb the cost of this, and hopefully to support research and efforts to combat this crisis on a broader level.
Do you believe that pharmaceuticals are to blame for the nation's opioid epidemic, or at least partly to blame?
The main thesis of my book, The United States of Opioids, is that while pharmaceutical companies are definitely villains in this story, the opioid crisis is much bigger, and it is a structural problem in our healthcare system where we need to look at what part the government played, what part insurance companies played, what part our history and lack of physician training on pain and addiction played. And most importantly of all, we have to look at the fact that even before the opioid crisis, we had at least two decades of an exponentially rising overdose death rate associated with other drugs. So I think this crisis marks a structural failure in our healthcare system beyond the drug makers, and I think it also marks a deep social crisis in America that needs attention. And that's not to take away from the bad conduct and the fact that drug companies should pay. It just means that we need to all be keeping our eye on the ball, paying attention to all of the additional work that has to happen beyond making drug makers pay.
That's Harry Nelson, managing partner of Los Angeles healthcare law firm Nelson Hardiman. He's also the author of The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain, just released book this week. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways. including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Wildlife experts are warning that the world's rarest great ape, discovered only in 2017, will not survive the building of a $1.6 billion hydroelectric power plant and dam in the middle of its remaining habitat in Sumatra, Indonesia. Only 800 of the newly identified Tapa Nuli orangutans remain in the wild, all in northern Sumatra's Batang Toru Forest. In the same area, the forest clearing has already begun for the project, which is being financed and built by state-controlled Chinese companies under China's Belt and Road Investment Initiative. As Jack Hewson reports, critics say it's the latest example of unsustainable development perpetuated by Chinese investment in Southeast Asia.
This is North Sumatra's rainforest, home to the Tapa Nuli orangutan. The Tapa Nuli are a new subspecies of the great ape, only discovered in 2017 in an area named Batang Toru. But with only 800 left, they are critically endangered. On top of this, a Chinese-backed hydro dam development is being built in the middle of their habitat. Although it will generate renewable energy, scientists and environmentalists say it could cause the orangutan's extinction.
Pembangunan PLTA itu merusak tempat mereka.
The project will destroy their habitat. The hydro dam will divide up the orangutan populations from each other.
Cross-area mating is necessary for orangutans to sustain their health, and isolation will only cause inbreeding, which is dangerous for the offspring. Activists also claim an earthquake could collapse the dam. The project is causing divisions in the community, particularly in downstream areas vulnerable to flooding. Local rubber farmer Arianto guided us past security into the dam site to show us his former farmland. He says he cooperated with the company initially, but then they didn't pay enough land compensation and did not give him a job as promised.
I reject this construction project because they violated my rights and lied about hiring us. Secondly, the land acquisition issue is not settled yet.
Talking to people in Batang Toru, we found that those who have been given work support the project and those who have not are against it or are indifferent. But very few people seem to care much about endangered species. As we walked out through the concession area, we were spotted by security. Heated words were exchanged with our guides for bringing in a foreign journalist, and we were quickly escorted out of the construction site. Here in Medan, NGOs have mounted a legal challenge against the dam, claiming the environmental assessment for the project was forged. Supporting them is Onrizal Onrizal, a scientist from the University of North Sumatra. Onrizal says he warned the company of the presence of endangered species, but says they did not include this in their final report and forged his signature here on the document.
So this document is not only biased, but false. Environmental assessment should be scientific research, but now they have falsified this. To me, that's an insult to science and scientists.
Despite Onrizal's allegations, a court in Medan this month failed even to consider his testimony as evidence and ruled in favor of the developers, North Sumatra Hydro Energy, or NSHE. In the capital, Jakarta, I met with Wimar Witola, the company's spokesperson, to ask him about Onrizal's allegations.
Onrizal is somebody I don't care to comment about in terms of personality. Maybe you should investigate just who and what he is. People have motives. You have motives. I have motives. Let each follow the motives.
Okay, well, your motive is to build a dam, which you've already...
My motive is to speak for the company who is going to build a dam, which has been approved by various scientific studies and the government and the people of North Sumatra.
Okay, so you have a clear, your company has a clear motivation to build this dam.
Oh yeah.
Which is a financial one as well. What motivation does Onrizal have to say that his signature was forged?
I do not know the motivations of people whose character are not like mine. In Indonesia we have many of those.
With an ongoing court case and the threat to biodiversity, the Batang Toru Hydro Dam remains mired in controversy. Much of the funding has come from the Bank of China, raising questions over the sustainability of the Belt and Road Investment Initiative. Jack Hewson, reporting for VOA News, Batang Toru, Indonesia.
Well, clothing worn by singer Marvin Gaye will go on display at the Motown Museum in Detroit as part of the music label's 60th anniversary celebration. The museum says that the items include a knit cap and a military-style jacket and pants. Pictures of them will be posted on Facebook and displayed at the museum beginning Saturday through the end of April. Earlier this year, the museum said it would display several items, including documents that show label founder Berry Gordy Jr.'s repayment of the $800 family loan that helped launch the company with a recording in 1959. The Motown Museum is located where Gordy launched his music empire. The Supremes, Stevie Wonder, The Miracles, and other performers recorded hits there before Motown moved in 1972 to California. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa your weekend destination.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.